I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. President Obama called sequestration, the automatic federal spending cuts that went into effect on Friday, just dumb. The president and Republican leaders were not able to reach a compromise on a mix of spending cuts, tax increases, and/or changes to the tax code. Republican leader Senator Mitch McConnell said, "I will not be part of any backroom deal, and I will absolutely not agree to an increase in taxes." Obama and members of his administration have been warning that those $1.2 trillion in cuts over the next decade were going to hurt the economy and segments of the population. On Sunday's Meet the Press, House Speaker John Boehner said, like every American, Washington has to make choices and live within its means. Today on Radio Times, the politics and impact of the sequester. We have two guests who have joined us both by telephone. Matt Welch is editor-in-chief of Reason, Libertarian Magazine. He blogs daily at Reason.com's Hit and Run. Co-authored a book called The Declaration of Independence, How Libertarian Politics Can Fix What's Wrong with America. And Matt Welch, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much for having me.
Also with us, Matthew Iglesias. He's Slate's business and economics correspondent. Before joining Slate, he worked for Think Progress, The Atlantic, TPM Media, and The American Prospect. His most recent book is The Rent is Too Damn High. And Matthew Iglesias, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
So good to be here.
Matthew, let me begin with you. We're a couple of days after sequester went into effect. Who do you think is going to be most affected?
There's going to be a lot of impact on sort of civilian contractors who work with the Defense Department. We've already seen big furloughs over there, so that's sort of the clearest, most direct impact. Then you're also going to see a lot of downstream impacts from people who depend on different kinds of government programs. You know, in any city in America, there's probably some homeless people who are going to lose out in services, things like that. But the biggest impact does come on people who contract directly with the federal government or on civilians who work with the federal government and are looking at some kinds of furloughs and things like that.
Matt Welch, how do you see those people who are impacted by sequester?
Basically the same. I mean, half of it comes in the form of defense cuts. So it's the people who are unused to a universe in which defense is ever cut who will be affected primarily and rapidly so. And then generally speaking, in addition to who Matthew was talking about, just bureaucracies themselves. I mean, the president called these dumb cuts. I think pretty much everyone calls them dumb cuts, which they on some level are. But bureaucracies are almost never tasked with managing the same amount of money year over year, let alone taking a bit of a trim. So it's difficult for them. Any large lumbering organization, whether private or public, has a bad time accepting cuts. And I think the government's a little bit worse at it than other people.
But Matt, do you think the fact that they are across the board, the idea is that it's the same amount of or same percentage that's cut from those various departments, does that make any sense to you?
Well, does politics make any sense to you, I guess, is one way of looking at that. From my point of view, and I am admittedly a limited government enthusiast who doesn't think that we should be as indebted as we are right now, any cut is better than no cut. And on some level, this is a pretty insignificant amount of money. On some level, the most significant part of this is as a demonstration project, not simply for can you ever cut government, but can you ever get a Republican to vote in favor of cutting military spending, which is something that was kind of unthinkable until a year and a half ago, and even kind of unthinkable 2 months ago. Now you're seeing at least some enthusiasm for that. So that, to me, is at least some breath of fresh air. And again, you're not going to get to a cut smartly. It's like working at a newspaper. If they've got to cut things, they offer buyouts, which is the dumbest form of cut you could ever come up with. But that's what happens to large bureaucracies. They're not good at making those smart cuts, and they won't do it unless they're pressured.
Let me pick up on the defense part of this spending cut. And Matthew, do you agree with Matt Welch that out of this, we're seeing about half of the cuts coming from the Defense Department?
Yeah, I mean, half of the cuts come from the military, and then it's an unusually sort of severe because there's a lot of things that the military isn't allowed to cut. They're not allowed to reduce spending on soldiers and active duty uniformed military personnel. So that means that quite large cuts need to come out of other aspects of the military budget. It's also, you know, Matt Welch was saying that it's difficult for large bureaucracies to sort of cut their budgets and tighten their belts intelligently. The problem with this is that it's actually illegal for the managers to try to handle this in a nuanced and intelligent way. My colleague Fred Kaplan wrote a good piece about this in the military context, and the Secretary of Defense essentially isn't allowed to look at the different procurement programs and say, you know, these three here, they're total boondoggles, let's just cancel that. Instead, each and every program has to go down by about 10%, and that's not an intelligent way to do those kinds of reductions. And, you know, an organization normally tries not to do things in that way. You tell people, look, you've got to spend a little less money, and then the goal is to try to identify a way to cut things that are truly wasteful. Instead, you're going to see a sort of across-the-board swing taken at different aspects of the budget. So it's problematic. At the same time, it is true this falls largely on the military, and I'm not someone who believes that the United States is underspending on its military. I don't think that, you know, the Mexican army is going to come storming over the border and conquer us as a result of this. So in that sense, you know, it could be viewed as fairly benign.
Matt, do you want to respond to that? And also looking over the last couple of years, we're talking about several $1 trillion of spending cuts and tax increases. Why do we need to keep cutting the budget, knowing how serious we have, serious problems we have with the economy itself, and also the fact that we have such a high rate of unemployment?
Well, I would agree.
Well, let me toss that first to you, Matt. We got two Matthews here. I'm going to toss that first to you, Matt Welch.
He's the Matthew.
Yeah, and Matthew, I'll get back to you. But go ahead, Matt.
Fair enough.
I would say that what is commonly described as a $1.2 trillion cut over the next 10 years is not going to result in $1.2 trillion being cut. That's the cut of expected increases. 10 years from now, we're going to have a much more expensive federal government than we have right now. So let's be clear about that. And that includes defense. Defense, if you look at the trend line, there's a bit of a hiccup happening right now, and then it's going to get back to the business of military spending as usual, and it's going to be a lot more 10 years from now. And always important to keep in mind, Matthew's completely right about the indiscriminate nature of the cuts and how there isn't as much leeway for managers to do things. But this is coming after 10 years of pretty hysterical government growth in terms of cost. Defense or military, depending on how you want to label it, it just had a run-up of 70% over 10 years. So, there was a time for smart cuts or maybe smart growth or smart anything. I would say a lot of that happened in the last 10 years. And, yes, a lot of that was under George W. Bush and Republican misrule of Washington. That's the time for those kind of decisions was then, and the federal government writ large has increased by an enormous amount since Bill Clinton left office. So these bureaucracies don't manage that money very well. So a lot of that, in my opinion, to the extent that this is going to be devastating anywhere, I think some of that has to be placed squarely on the shoulders of the managers who've been overseeing this run-up in costs over the last 10 years.
But do you think, Matthew Iglesias, that this focus on debt and sequestration has distracted from the fact that we have underemployment and a high rate of unemployment in this country, and we haven't had the kind of economic growth that I think that would support a developed country like the United States?
Yes, I mean, I think it's very unfortunate that the conversation in Washington has been so focused on this debt and deficit issue for a number of years now. Matt Welch talked about the growth in the federal government over the past 10, 15 years, which is true, but already over the past 2 or 3 years, horizon spending has been on a downward trajectory. That was something Republicans insisted on when they took over Congress. The White House has been, I think, sympathetic to the idea that we need deficit reduction, although calling for more tax increases and somewhat less spending cuts. And it has, I think, gotten our eyes off the ball of the question of unemployment. The Congressional Budget Office and the Federal Reserve keep coming out with these reports, and they talk about the long-term damage it does to the economy to have people out of work for years and years and years. You know, if you lose your job and you're unemployed for a month or 3 months or 4 months, it's okay. You'll get another job eventually. When people are out of the workforce for a year or 2 years, you know, they lose skills, they lose attachment to the labor markets, and the sort of the long-term capacity of the economy is really hurt. And it's unfortunate that we've been focused on this kind of budget quibbling and short-term belt tightening rather than looking at ways to sort of create jobs and get people to work. And also this sequester, I mean, what's really unfortunate about the sequestration process is that while it does cut government spending, it doesn't cut the Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid programs that sort of account for the long-term projected growth in the deficit. So it doesn't help us that much with the long-term fiscal challenge while kind of hurting us in the short term with labor market. Well, so it's a pretty poor match.
Well, and let me just pick up on that and toss this to you, Matt Welch. And this is looking more, I guess, at the politics or even the process, which is the inability of government to come up with something that addresses what looks like real future problems for this U.S. economy.
Well, let's remember why we got here. We got here because back in 2011, even 2010, there was discussion about precisely those long-term fiscal promises, entitlements that are coming up, and how this is going to wreak havoc on budgets and just an ability to do anything besides those programs, which is something that's been brought up by successive Democratic presidents. Bill Clinton spent most of his State of the Union addresses in the late 90s talking about how we got to do this or it's going to get us. And when Obama first got into office, or even before, he said, you know, that this, we're no longer going to kick the can down the road on this thing. And so as a way of trying to go after these long-term cuts, they put a commission together and then said, okay, if we can't figure this thing out, here's the backup plan, and we'll do these kind of dumb-sounding sequestration cuts. And in the process, the conversation about reforming those entitlements hasn't completely been snuffed out, but effectively been snuffed out. It's not really part of anybody's negotiations. It didn't really come up in the fiscal cliff process that led to the tax increase in January 1st or 2nd. It hasn't really been part of the sequestration talks, and that is completely unfortunate. And it's a symbol of a generational kind of inability and cowardice on the part of politicians to go after this in an intelligent way. And I don't see anything on the near-term horizon to say that that's going to come up again.
But Matthew, do we have two sets of problems? One is a short-term problem trying to deal with the current problems in the U.S. economy, and then a long-term problem that has to do with things like entitlements.
Well, that's true. I mean, there's short-term issues and there's long-term issues. But I also think it's important to be clear about what's the sort of proximate source of the political gridlock here, which is that, the Obama administration says they will do entitlement reforms if and only if Republicans agree to some substantial tax increases. And Republicans have said they don't want to agree to that, that they want an all-cuts package. And, you know, that's fine. I mean, I think sometimes people get sort of too on their high horse and red in the face about obstructionism and so on and so forth. The two parties simply have a disagreement about this. The Democrats have a position that happens to be more popular, and so Republicans sometimes get a little fishy about what are they really doing here. But the fact is, you know, Democrats want to do a sort of what they call a balanced approach where there's tax increases and there's entitlement cuts. Republicans say that, you know, taxes are not too low. If anything, taxes are too high, and so they don't want to make a deal with President Obama. And so we're waiting until someone wins an enough elections and has enough political strength to sort of impose a partisan solution on this dynamic. And I think that's all okay. I mean, it's fine for people to disagree. What would be nice is if we could, given that they disagree, sort of try to shift the conversation and talk about something else. There's lots of other issues on the table. We don't need to just keep fighting on this one front. We could try to work on something where there may be less of a sharp divide between the parties.
Well, maybe we'll try to do that after this very short break. That's Matthew Iglesias joining us with Matt Welch, and beginning our conversation talking about sequestration, the politics, and impact. Stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the Academy of Vocal Arts, presents Don Quixote, March 2nd through 9th, in AVA's Helen Corning Warden Theater, and March 12th and 14th at Centennial Hall in Haverford. Jules Massenet's opera is a lyrical ode to the chivalrous idealist Don Quixote. Christopher Makatsouris conducts the AVA Opera Orchestra with staging by Tito Capobianco. 215-735-1685 or avaopera.org.
The budgetary discussions currently taking place in Washington present challenges for people in our community and for WHYY. Yet, at the same time, we have continued to expand our services. I'm Bill Morazzo. Your support to WHYY in the last 5 years has offset government losses, yet resulted in the growth of the services you rely on. A donation today will enable us to continue to fulfill our promise to you. Visit WHYY.org to make a donation.
What do ABBA and death metal have in common? A Nordic country of ice and snow with a big musical footprint. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. This week on Sound Opinions, we look at pop powerhouse Sweden. DJ Stefan Vermelin is our guide through Swedish pop history, from ABBA to Robin.
If you're looking for love, get a heart made of steel, 'cause you know that love kills.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with Matt Welch, editor-in-chief of Reason, the libertarian magazine. He blogs daily at reason.com's Hit and Run. Wrote a book a couple of years ago called The Declaration of Independence, How Libertarian Politics Can Fix What's Wrong with America. Also with us, Matthew Iglesias. He's Slate's business and economics correspondent. Wrote a book last year called The Rent is Too Damn High. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. So, Matt, what is your suggestion, or even the libertarian point of view, about how to get this economy growing again?
Well, there's a huge difference of opinion between probably myself and Matthew, and certainly between kind of standard democratic/liberal economists and those of a more libertarian on fiscally conservative bent. Libertarians are more apt to believe, and I think they're right, obviously, that big government isn't good for the economy, that stimulus spending itself has a very spotty track record, that when you cut government, you can, in that process, encourage growth to happen, as happened after World War II in this country, happened in Canada in the 90s, New Zealand in the 80s, large swaths of Central Europe at various points. For the most part, I would say, and Matthew will correct me, but the feeling among Democratic economists nowadays is that when the economy is in trouble, the federal government needs to spend money to sort of pick up aggregate demand and stimulate growth that way. So that's just a difference of opinion. Sure. It's a strong one. It's a fundamental one. So I think that you have to cut the size of government and get it also out of the business of regulating areas that it doesn't need to be regulating in as much as it is right now. And Matthew has written about this on a local level to a great effect, and he could talk about more. But that's where I begin that process. But we're a long way away from it. I think we're facing more of a Japanese model type of thing, which is just long-range indebtedness and stagnation and very low growth.
And I do want to get back to that for some more specifics, but I guess philosophically, Matthew Iglesias, like to have you weigh in on that.
You know, I think in some ways the philosophical debate over fiscal stimulus gets overstated in this country to some extent. Matt Welch was talking about there's a disagreement about government spending, and that's very true. I mean, there's a sort of big picture ideological disagreement about the value of certain kinds of public sector programs. But, you know, the debate about sort of fiscal stimulus and growth, you know, technically you can use tax cuts just as much to increase the deficit and stimulate demand. There was a large tax cut element to the Obama stimulus. George W. Bush and Nancy Pelosi came together to do an all-tax cut stimulus in 2008, things like that. So, you know, if you believe that at a time when the Federal Reserve has put interest rates sort of all the way to the floor, you still have a lot of unemployment and the government should come up with something more to do to juice the economy, there's a lot of different ways you could do it that sort of get around different people's hang-ups about the merits of different kinds of programs. But what you do have is like a really big disagreement about, you know, should the federal government be providing health care for people? This has obviously been a big point of emphasis for the Obama administration, was expanding the number of people who get that. At the same time, it's quite costly to provide health care to lots of people. And people on the right want to sort of roll that back, want to roll back Medicare's coverage of elderly people, things like that. And that's where you get a philosophical disagreement. It's difficult to say that it's a question of we're going to like run the numbers and come up with the truth about this. It has to do, there's numbers involved, but a lot of it it has to do with sort of moral stances that people take and views of the public good and the public interest. And it's really, it's an important disagreement, and it's unfortunate that we sometimes have these sort of silly consequences of partisan gridlock, but it's a big thing, and it's worth people taking a stand on.
Well, and picking up on your philosophy, Matt Welch, then where would you cut government, or what do you think are the essential responsibilities of government?
Oh, golly gee.
Go ahead.
No, I think you cut military spending a lot more than it is right now. We spend almost 50% of the world's money on military and defense. I think it's just kind of unconscionable. I think we have to withdraw a lot of our overseas commitments in general. I don't think 900 military bases are necessarily what we need. I would eliminate all farm subsidies and most of, if not all of, the Department of Agriculture, which now has something more than 100,000 employees. One of these days we're going to have more Department of Agriculture employees than we are going to have farmers left in this country. The Department of Commerce, I'm not really sure why we need a federal department to manage commerce in any given way. And I'm just a big free trader and more immigration. I think that would have a great, stimulative effect on the economy and would be the moral right thing to do for the poor people of the world.
How do you see that, Matthew?
I think there's some ideas in there that I agree with, and it's good that the Senate Democrats have proposed cutting farm subsidies as part of their sequester alternative. I think that's a good idea. To stand up for the Department of Commerce a little bit, it sounds obscure, but it oversees things like the National Weather Service, which is a very valuable thing to us all in our daily lives. It has a lot of good commercial applications. The Bureau of Economic Analysis, similarly, it's super boring, but what they're doing is they're gathering statistical information about what's happening in the United States. And both of those are examples where, knowledge, basic facts about the world are kind of public good, right? You can produce that information on a private basis, but then it becomes proprietary. You have a lot of overlap, things like that. It's very useful to regular people, to business people of different kinds, to scholars, to have these kind of statistical data out there. That's not to say there's nothing happening in the Commerce Department that we couldn't live without, but, the ability to run a sort of a credible federal government where people sort of trust that when these GDP estimates come out and other aspects of basic census data that the Commerce Department does, it's useful, and it reminds us that there is some real value there in the government, along with some things that we could probably do without. But again, in the long term, the big driver of costs is that we've committed to paying the health care bills for elderly Americans. The number of elderly people is going up, and also the cost of providing health care is going up. And so, if you can address that in a reasonable way, you save a lot of money, you create a lot of room for other things. And if you don't address it, no amount of sort of quibbling with how many people are in the Department of Agriculture building is ultimately going to solve the problem.
Matt Welch, I'm looking at something from the Pew Research Center asking people, the public, about where they think the government should make cuts. And on the top of the list is aid to the world's needy, followed by the State Department, followed by unemployment aid. These are tiny portions of the federal government. And I wonder whether the public either doesn't understand where most of the money goes, or that they have programs that they enjoy and support from the government and they don't want them touched.
The answer is yes.
Yes to both?
to an extent. No, Americans are sort of famously, they have the broad sense that government is spending too much and doing too much, and I believe they're right about that. And then when you break it down to specifics, suddenly it gets a little bit more difficult. We do polling over at Reason, where we try to ask follow-up questions and get a sense of trade-offs out there. It's true, definitely the entitlements that need to be reformed are popular, and that is at the root of so much agony in politics, particularly among Republicans, I would say, more than Democrats, because Democrats can just say we're in favor of it, great. But Republicans right now have a caucus who want to tackle this forthrightly, and then they have another caucus, broadly called it the Karl Rove Caucus, which will say, please don't talk about that, you're going to lose elections, which I think was, for the most part, Mitt Romney's approach during this past election. So they're in a bind and in pickle over this right now, and you do have to make politics for that. The way I would look at it long term, Matthew's right about these entitlement promises being the big long-term game. I don't see a way mathematically, astrologically in any way, that you're not going to have an inevitable showdown between entitlements and a safety net. I think we're going to have to choose whether you, at the age of 65, get this no matter what, or whether or not your interest is helping for people who are poor and infirm and have a more difficult time caring for themselves. It's a showdown, and this will be a showdown even if government grows at the rate that it did under George W. Bush, because that's money, that spending is going to crowd out discretionary spending, and then the interest payments are going to crowd out everything else too. So it's going to feel like government is shrinking, even if it's not. So people are going to have to come clean on that soon.
And that's Matt Welch, editor in chief of the libertarian magazine called Reason. Also with us, Matthew Iglesias. He is a Slate's business and economics correspondent. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Talking about debt, sequestration, jobs, growing the economy. Matthew Iglesias, let me toss something to you, then we'll get to our callers. Do you think there are lessons to be drawn from what's going on in Europe, where there has been some pretty severe budget cutting? We are seeing some effects in the unemployment rate and some effects in the strength of their economies.
You know, it's a little difficult to apply the European situation directly to the United States because the underlying monetary dynamics are quite different. But you do see that simply budget cutting, which you've seen a lot of in Spain and Italy and Portugal, you know, has not helped the economies there. It's just sort of thrown more people out of work because the basic demand situation isn't as good. But also the European debate is quite different from the American debate. They really have had a push there to cut the deficit per se, and that's meant a lot of spending cuts, but also a lot of tax increases. Here, we've really just been talking about the spending side because there's simply no agreement between Democrats and Republicans on the tax piece. But, you know, there was a promise from EU officials when they started this austerity sort of program that you were going to see people say, oh, these countries are finally getting serious, and then there's going to be a huge surge in business investment. And you haven't seen anything like that. Instead, you know, programs have been cut, salaries have been cut, taxes have been raised, and the private sector is just limping along as it always, you know, as it had been previously.
Let me get some callers in. Looks like we have Willie from Philadelphia. And Willie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi.
Hi there.
My question's mostly for Matt Welch.
Sure.
And I wanted to ask, because he mentioned the government needs to be doing less regulating, he said. We're at a time of environmental peril, I feel like, and how would he have business regulate themselves on the environment?
Matt Welch. Go ahead, Matt.
I wouldn't. I mean, you might get some libertarians to say they don't want any environmental regulation, but in fact, it is about the best example you can come up with you know, you have a commons problem. Who has the property right to the air? Who has the property right to a river that goes through 13 states? That is where regulation makes the most philosophical and, I think, practical sense. That doesn't mean that the EPA is doing the Lord's work on any given day, and that it couldn't have a lot of its programs scaled back or eliminated or whatever. But I think environmental regulation, much more so than other types of regulation, makes more philosophical and practical sense than other types.
Do you agree with that, Matthew?
Well, I mean, I certainly agree that the environment is something we need to regulate. I mean, it's unfortunate, you know, people say, well, there's too much or there's too little regulation. The fact is we under-regulate some things and we over-regulate some other things, and the one can't compensate for the other. We need to do more, I think, to prevent certain kinds of air pollution, other things like that, and probably less to meddle with the kind of details of how people are operating their businesses. But, you know, I mean, I do think environmental regulation is a huge problem, and it's something that, unfortunately, we've sort of stopped talking about over the past several years. When Democrats ran Congress, you know, there was a big push to do a big overhaul of the approach to climate change. It got very controversial. The bill got pretty convoluted. But people were at least talking at that time about, well, was there a better approach than the one Obama was pushing? Were there ways to improve this kind of legislation? It ended up dying, and we've just sort of lost the thread altogether. And, you know, people are, I think, going to look back 50, 100 years from now, and they're not going to say that this sequester and the question of, you know, did we furlough 7% of airport security people was the really important thing that happened in 2013, people are going to say that this was a period in time when the world was considering, you know, are we going to try to do something about climate change? And by and large, didn't do anything.
Willie, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Matt Welch, let me toss this to you and then we'll get back to our callers. One of the arguments for raising taxes is folks look back at the Clinton years and even the years under Ronald Reagan. Both presidents raised taxes and there was a pretty broad satisfaction for economic growth. What's your response to that?
I would happily trade Bill Clinton's tax rates for Bill Clinton's spending rates. That's not on the table by either party. You know, if we would have kept Bill Clinton's last budget and grew that at the rate of inflation and population growth, we would probably be talking about surpluses right now and not about this ocean of red ink that we're in. I think Republicans have tied themselves into knots and helped make mincemeat of the tax code by putting tax, opposing tax hikes over everything else, like thinking that you could be considered a true fiscal conservative if you just signed Grover Norquist's pledge to never raise taxes. I think that put a lot of pressure on people to carve out special exemptions that therefore would never be touched, which increases complexity, and it's a cheap date. You're not actually in favor of limiting government unless you limit government, which Republicans did not do under their watch. So, I mean, James Buchanan, the late Nobel economist, had talks about what the permanent disconnect. This is back in the 80s when it really started under Reagan. Permanent disconnect between government revenues and government expenditures. When bureaucrats and politicians realized they could just borrow forever, then we didn't really need to have a balanced budget or just, you know, numbers that resembled one another. And we don't anymore. This is problematic, and so, you know, get there by however means you need to get there or get closer to there. I think you'd have more honesty in government on many levels. But let's also remember, we just raised taxes. I mean, there was 77% of Americans are paying more taxes now than they were 2 months ago. And I think by an average of something like $1,200, although the median is probably lower. So there was raising taxes as part of this. For me, where the rubber hits the road is cutting government, not on tax policy.
Matthew Iglesias, any reason to increase taxes for any group in this country?
Well, you know, I mean, I think we've seen a huge increase in inequality over the past several decades. And so that makes a strong case that some of deficit reduction should be done through higher taxes on higher-income Americans. And, you know, that's sort of the line the president's drawn in the sand. And I think that Republicans, by being really intransigent on this point, on the one hand, you know, they've made life difficult for the White House because they don't sort of get the accomplishments that they would want. But on the other hand, they've made things very easy for Democrats, which is that since Republicans have held so firm on this one idea, it's made it very easy for the whole Democratic coalition to hang together on the opposite side. And I wrote a column last week saying, you know, John Boehner should really think about stepping up here and, to an extent, calling the administration's bluff and saying, you know, fine, we're willing to do a substantial tax increase. We're willing for a lot of that to come out of high-income people. But then here are our ideas on spending that we want to see you embrace in order to get that. That would make things much more difficult for the Democrats. I mean, it's very controversial inside the Democratic Party. Should you cut Social Security benefits at all? What should you do about Medicare? But those issues are not really on the table because the Democrats can all say completely accurately that Republicans are not willing to meet them at all on the tax piece, and it's sort of stumped the whole system up. And so I think Republicans have to ask themselves, how badly do they want spending cuts? If they want them really badly, they have to do the thing that it takes to get them in a bargain, which is agree to some higher taxes. If they do that, then I think Obama's going to have to give it to them. And if not, it'll be really sort of politically disastrous for Democrats because the voters are very clear that they do want to see higher taxes from the rich as part of a deal, but also that they think a budget deficit should be mostly closed with tax cuts. So that's terrain that Republicans should be able to play
on.
Right, spending cuts, yes.
They're playing my song. I got to jump in here. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Composed in 1822, it went unperformed for over 40 years, never finished, heard only in Schubert's imagination. Christoph von Dohnányi leads the Philadelphia Orchestra in Schubert's unfinished symphony and also leads Bruckner's fourth symphony, The Romantic. Tickets at 215-893-1999 or philorc.org. March 14th, 15th, and 16th at the Kimmel Center, Schubert's unfinished symphony with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
people are living under the illusion that the American dream is working for them, and it's rigged by the guys at the tippy top.
Laura Dern plays a naive whistleblower on the HBO series Enlightened. On the next Fresh Air, her co-creator and co-star Mike White tells us about the season finale. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Hooking up is described as having a fleeting, uncommitted sexual encounter, no strings attached. Surveys show more young adults are having casual sex, and researchers are exploring psychological and other consequences of these seemingly loveless meetups. On the next Voices in the Family with Dr. Dan Gottlieb, a conversation about sexual hookup culture. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, and I just interrupted Matthew Iglesias. He's Slate's business and economics correspondent. He wrote a book that came out last year called The Rent is Too Damn High. Matt Welch, also with us, editor-in-chief of the libertarian magazine Reason, wrote a book 2 years ago, co-authored a book called The Declaration of Independence, How Libertarian Politics Can Fix What's Wrong with America. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Matt, did you want to add something to what Matthew was saying?
I was just trying to correct his tax cuts, spending cuts thing. But I would just add that Republicans have not shown, until recently, within a minority faction of Republicans, any desire for those spending cuts. It was a comical thing to watch during the 2012 election, and was so during the fiscal cliff. Whenever you actually ask a Republican, okay, what would you cut? Crickets. You know, Mitt Romney ran to the left of Obama on some level when it comes to Medicare cuts, and he certainly ran in the primary season to the left of the field, in the Republican field, on stuff like Social Security reform and military spending. So Republicans have not shown an appetite for spending cuts except until recently, and even then it's very, very small. John Boehner, in his heart of hearts, I do not believe, really thinks that cutting government is an important thing. He's just feeling the pressure from the grassroots underneath him.
Let me get back to our callers. Looks like we have Judy from Lansdowne joining us on Radio Times. And Judy, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thanks. You just mentioned the individual people where some Republicans say, why are we fussing about cutting 2% of the budget? It's such a small amount, yet the impact of that 2% is like 98% on individual people. And it's great to talk about economic policy and philosophical ideas, but, you know, what about us? What about people who, you know, lose their homes as a consequence of this? Or, you know, what about those furloughed civilian military? Let's talk about the impact on individual people in this country for whom these are not entitlements. This is their life.
Sure. No, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, Judy. Matthew, let me give you a first chance to respond to her call.
Sure. I mean, you know, I don't want to make light of the impact of this sequestration process on some people. I mean, for example, there's a program called Women, Infants, and Children,
right,
that provides nutritional assistance to low-income pregnant women and their infants. That program is getting cut. That's very sad. You know, we are not in this large national debt because we're doing too much to sort of help low-income newborn babies, but they are getting the cut. And of course, you know, it's easy to say, and I do think that we, in fact, spend too much money on the military and on national defense. At the same time, you know, it's sad when people lose their jobs or lose their incomes. These are hardworking, decent Americans, and it's a shame to see anybody suffer, particularly in this sort of bad economic climate. Mm. So, you know, I think in some ways the impact of the sequestration can be overstated. In other ways, it can be understated. You know, this is a big country, so even small cuts have big impacts on the lives of many hundreds of thousands of people, and it's something we should think about.
Well, and a piece in the New York Times, Matt Welch, Matthew mentioned the WIC program, but also vouchers for housing to the poor and disabled could be cut. And, of course, that has an impact on individuals who are at the margins of society.
I don't think that 2.3% of cuts are going to impact 98% of the country. They will impact some individual people. My father worked in the defense industry for 40 years. So it might have made it harder for him to make a freelance income, which is something I wouldn't really weep over. And not just because of my personal animus towards my father, but at some point you ask yourself, is this something that the government should be doing? Is his job, does it make sense? And on some level, one could argue that it does not. And that sounds like a heartless bastard talking about, but at the same time, you have to say, is the government there to provide people jobs, or is it there to provide essential services that wouldn't get done otherwise? That is my ultimate concern with the way that we spend and manage the government. Individual programs that hurt individual people, to the extent that those programs should be there and those people should get that money, but I think already we're starting to put a lot of qualifiers in what at the end is going to be a pretty insignificant trim year over year in the size of government.
Judy, thanks for the call to Radio Times. So picking up on that, Matthew Iglesias, let me go back to you. We have done a number of programs over the last couple of months about food stamps and poverty and the fact that you've got growing numbers of poor people in this country, including working poor. There's a whole segment of the population in America that has, you know, is essentially stuck in low-wage jobs. And it seems like anything, the sequester does nothing to really deal with that serious problem.
Yes, I mean, that's true. And fundamentally, you know, people at the lower end of the income spectrum need a healthier labor market. Even people who have jobs struggle to get pay increases in a time when so many people don't have jobs. It's simply not that credible. If you remember a time like 1999, when the unemployment rate was very low, I lived right by a Taco Bell and a Wendy's and a couple fast food restaurants like that, and they constantly had help wanted signs out front because, you know, they weren't able to offer people enough raises to sort of keep them on staff. And when you have a healthy economy, you know, it benefits in some ways the poor the most. And as Matt Welch was saying, there is something of a trade-off between these programs that go to elderly people and programs that are targeted on low-income people. And unfortunately, what we've chosen to do in the last several rounds of budget cutting is disproportionately cut spending on anti-poverty programs and on that discretionary budget rather than tackling some of the stuff that goes to healthcare providers and other things through the retirement services. And, you know, it's something that we should be mindful of, that the big entitlement programs are a little bit more iconic to liberals and to Democrats than something smaller like food stamps or WIC or Section 8 housing vouchers. But it matters a great deal. You know, I mean, programs that help low-income families have a place to live are sort of more morally significant in my mind than programs that help middle-class senior citizens get somewhat discretionary medical care.
Let me see what Dave from Cherry Hill has to say. And Dave, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I listened to sequestrations and states' ballot budget amendments, and I can't help but reaching the conclusion that they're a device for a lot of the politicians to go back to whatever unions, trade organizations, and PACs were paying for the elections, going to them and saying, well, we didn't vote against your program that hurts whatever your agenda is, so please make sure you continue to fund us. It's not our fault. It's the balanced budget amendment or it's sequestration.
David, let me see. I think I understand what you're saying, but let me see if Matt Welch understands what you're saying. Matt?
Well, there's no doubt that public sector unions in particular have a strong influence in politics and that politicians respond to their desires and concerns. You see this, it's not just a Democratic thing, although I think it's disproportionately a Democratic thing. Republicans are more about public safety unions. And this is maybe more on a local and state level than it is on a national level, although certainly teachers' unions and other things play on the national level as well. And, yeah, that's a factor. I mean, we have entitlement promises made federally, but we have a lot of pension promises made locally that are really causing all kinds of headaches in places like California and Illinois and Rhode Island and elsewhere. And that is definitely part of the political process. And it's not an accident. I mean, there's a great old phrase coined by Charles Peters, the founder of Washington Monthly magazine, called Fireman First, which is, you know, whenever a bureaucrat has to face a threatened budget cut, you know, run around, look for your nearest fireman to stand next to and say, see, this is the thing that you love about government, one of the only things that you love about government, that is what's going to be hurt first by this. So there's a politics for it, and there's also a kind of a more mechanistic process of that. And, yeah, they mm-hmm. are a significant player in these discussions, and we'll always hear about threatened teacher layoffs, and yet somehow teachers stubbornly refuse to get laid off in this process.
Dave, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Do you agree with that, Matthew Iglesias?
Well, I mean, I agree with some of it. At the same time, I mean, there really are many fewer teachers, public school teachers, employed right. in the United States than there were 3 or 4 years ago. I mean, layoffs are a very real thing. You know, I think that if you want to make a complaint about sort of the public sector interest in this regard, the thing to do is to say that, you know, the way they structure their contracts encourages governments to lay people off or to furlough workers rather than doing a sort of smaller pay decrease across the board, which might be sort of a more sensible way to handle these things. So, for example, we're talking about the situation in airport security, and they need to cut 7% of the spending on, you know, the guys who run the metal detectors, that right. kind of thing. Right. But instead of cutting their salaries by 7%, they're essentially laying 7% of them off. And it's hard to say, really, I mean, why that's in the interests of the country as a whole, or even really why it's in the interests of the people working there. Obviously, it's people don't like to see their salaries cut. But if you didn't want to work for that lower pay, you know, you could leave and try to get a job elsewhere. If you didn't, then we could keep running the system. So we do have a distorting impact in the lack of flexibility with how to manage these agencies that exist.
Dave, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We'll get back to our callers. But let me ask you something, Matt Welch. And while I don't think it would make a huge or even perceptible difference in the government spending, the fact that no one in Congress put their salaries on the line when it came to sequester, do you think they would have had more sympathy or could make a stronger argument if they said, hey, we're going to take 5 or 6% cut because we're going to feel the pain that, you know, some of these civilian workers feel in the Defense Department?
Well, didn't the Republicans do that as part of their extension of the debt ceiling last time around? The House Republicans, I should say. They said that the Senate will no longer be paid if they don't produce a budget for the first time since 2009. So, yeah, I think there's a little bit of monkeying around with that on the edges. It's symbolic and it doesn't really amount to much. Mm. Ultimately, I'm perfectly fine with that. But again, to me, it's more appalling at the local level. I lived in Los Angeles for a long time, and city council in there makes something like $180,000 a year. At some point, it does get pretty ridiculous. I recommend everyone who's listening to this and who's interested in the topic, go to the Senate Appropriations Committee website, because there they've collected all the kind of scaremongering letters. And I think it's really been kind of a shameful episode how much Leon Panetta and other people have been scaremongering about the effects of the sequester. But they've got all these things listed, and it's a mix of the sky is really going to fall, our Air Force is not going to be able to fly, that kind of discussion. And then just the kind of small bureaucratic, like, really, we were even doing this type of things. Like, the Small Business Administration is worried that it might have to close some of its 900 small business centers around the country. And why is the Small Business Administration even have 900 small business centers? What is going on here? Mm. So it's a pretty good cross-section of the mix of weird and essential things that the federal government does.
Let me get, looks like Kit from Glenside to join us. And Kit, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I had a comment relative to the spending side of things.
Sure.
And thinking back to the Russian model, the Soviet Union model, and watching them kind of basically financially unravel as they tried to keep pace with the United States in military spending, I wonder if our economy, or as our economy slows down and more jobs are farmed out of the economy, I wonder if we might not be doing the same thing since we refuse, at least on the conservative side of the aisle, to address any cuts in spending in the military. And that's my comment.
I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Kit, let me toss that to you, Matthew Iglesias. Are there lessons we could learn from the USSR?
I think that's probably an overstated comparison, but I do think that if there is something good about the sequestration process, it's that Republicans were taking a good hard look at this military component. That was supposed to be like the lever with which Democrats were going to force them to give ground on taxes, is the White House was going to say, look at these terrible, terrible cuts to the military. And Republicans took the bait for a while and tried to say, oh, this is terrible and it's all Obama's fault and, you know, Iranians are going to conquer us. But then they did look at it and they realized, you know, they really don't want to raise taxes and that this smaller military spending is something that they can live with. And I think that's great. You know, I really do think we should consider, why do we need to spend this much? And isn't the long-term security of the country is going to rest more on our prosperity and our ability to have private enterprises and our ability to invest in government programs that, you know, really help people rather than on sort of excess military equipment and, you know, bases all around the world and things like that. So I see this as that aspect of it is a positive development.
But also, Matt, when you dig a little deeper, you see that there are government and military contracts all over the country, in districts all over the country that are, you know, that are employing people. So it's not like it's not going to have an impact.
Oh, it's going to
have
an
impact.
Yeah, go ahead, Matt Welch. And then, Matthew, I'll give you a chance as well. Go ahead, Matt.
It is going to have an impact for sure. There was significant impact, you know, in my hometown, Long Beach, California, after the end of the Cold War, when we shut down the naval base there and when aerospace spending went way down and it jacked up unemployment in California in the early 90s. And yes, that was bad for the people who had been employed, you know, the day before. But was it bad for the country as a whole, for the economy as a whole, and for federal spending as a whole? I have a hard time believing that.
Well, and to you, Matthew Iglesias, go ahead.
This is not the best time to be doing this. If I could sort of play budget God, you know, I would have increased defense spending much less back in 2004, 2005, 2006 when the unemployment rate was low. Right now, people who lose their jobs are going to have a very difficult time finding new work. When in a healthier time, it might have been easier to do it. So it's unfortunate that we've come to this pass. But I agree with what Matt Welch is saying. Ultimately, I mean, the military serves a very important function, and we should have one, and we should spend the money that we need to spend on it, but it shouldn't be a make-work program for people or just a way of dispensing jobs. I mean, ultimately, we need an economy that employs people doing things that are worthwhile and not just creating jobs for its own sake.
Well, we're going to end on that note, and my thanks to the two Matthews for joining us today in Radio Times. Matthew Iglesias, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Matt Welch, thank you very much as well.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
You're welcome. Matt Welch is editor-in-chief of the libertarian magazine called Reason, co-authored a book 2 years ago called The Declaration of Independence, How Libertarian Politics Can Fix What's Wrong with America. And Matthew Iglesias is Slate's business and economics correspondent. And his most recent book came out last year is called The Rent is Too Damn High. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, but stay with us. We'll be right back.